It's Friday, December 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, the humanitarian crisis in Syria deepens.
The fate of our nation, the greatness of America, the character of our country has been under assault.
Democrats try to rally after election defeat. Also ahead, Donald Trump banks on his new Treasury Secretary to boost the economy. Alleged palm oil abuse in Indonesia and the top paid musicians are all on today's International Edition. The United Nations humanitarian chief urged states with influence to do everything within their power to protect civilians in eastern Aleppo, to save what was once Syria's largest city from becoming one giant graveyard. Stephen O'Brien told an emergency Security Council meeting on Wednesday that up to 25,000 people have been displaced from rebel-held districts in eastern Aleppo since the weekend, but the numbers change by the hour and the day. Many of those have fled to the main shelter in Jibrin, southeast of Aleppo, where an old factory is being used to house over 8,000 people. But with that camp full to capacity, a second has just opened nearby to take in the new influx of people fleeing the fighting. James Denslow is senior conflict advisor at Save the Children UK.
I think the English language fails us when it comes to describing what's currently happening there. It's a slow-motion car crash, and as UNICEF has said, and as we are deeply concerned about, 100,000 children, some 40% of the eastern Aleppo population before the last 2 weeks of violence, are trapped and under the bombs.
While the world's attention has been focused on more than 250,000 civilians trapped in eastern Aleppo, UN Humanitarian Chief Stephen O'Brien underscored that there are 700,000 more people in other besieged areas across Syria. Pavel Shushak, Director of Communications for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Syria, was speaking in Damascus and tells International Edition host Sarah Williams about the concerns.
The ICRC's primary concern and objective is to reach the people who have been recently displaced with very much needed humanitarian aid. This is what we have been doing since 27th of November, when the people started massively fleeing into the western side of Aleppo. Together with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, we managed to reach those people in the collective shelters with the very, very basic supplies yet very much needed, such as sanitation facilities, blankets, mattresses, food, potable water. The situation in these collective shelters, I mean, is very desperate. The people are arriving really with very little belongings, very terrified, very tired. I mean, so many of them need medical aid, so such medical care has to be provided to them. And we are trying to respond as much as we can as the situation evolves, of course, because what we've seen in the past 48, 72 hours, I mean, this is only the part of the response. Yesterday, as our teams were there, colleagues told me that the people, people were kept coming in the buses from the front lines.
I believe that your organization, the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Syria, is calling on all sides fighting in Aleppo to try to protect the civilian escalation. Do you think that will be possible?
Well, of course, we hope that is possible. I mean, whatever we can do is to only call on the parties to protect the civilians, to guarantee them safe passages. We have to remember those people taking enormous risks trying to flee. Well, first of all, they're doing it in the midst of a very heavy fighting, the mortars, sniper fire, explosions, shelling. So they already take a lot of risks and they must be guaranteed the protection and the safe passage where they decide to flee. However, I mean, what we can do is, of course, to appeal. It's actually in the hands of the parties to guarantee the civilians the safe passage, of course.
Now, I believe your colleagues were allowed to travel to a district in East Aleppo. It's called Hanano. What were the conditions there like?
So, yes, indeed, we managed to, we were granted actually the access to one of the eastern districts of Hanano, which has been the district that has been, that was a scene on heavy clashes a couple of days ago, from where thousands are believed to flee in all possible directions. The place was empty. The place was deserted. We came there to make the assessment of the living conditions, to try to see where we can actually make the improvements to the huge, you know, destruction amongst the civilian properties, because at some point the people will start returning to these places, and in fact this is what we hear from the people. We want to go back home, and we have to, right now, as humanitarian organization, do everything to help or to improve our living conditions.
Pavel Shushak, who is Director of Communications for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Syria. Time now for our social media segment, and with International Edition's G. Abby Lee here in our studio, we delve into American pharmaceutical executive Martin Shkreli. that guy. The guy we all hate. He's the most hated man in America, and he's trending again. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. So the reason why the media nicknamed him is the most hated man in America is because he jacked up the price of Daraprim, a medication used to treat parasitic infections, from $13.50 to $750 per pill at some point. It is reported that he lowered the price below $750 for now, but I'm not sure about the exact price. Anyways, students at Sidway Grammar School in Australia found a cheap way to create the active ingredients of that drug, and the cost came out to be $2 per pill. And naturally, Shkreli was not pleased. He tweeted, "These kids who made Daraprim," in quotation marks, "reminds me of Ahmed who made the clock. Dumb journalists want a feel-good story." He also tweeted, "Labor and equipment costs. Didn't know you could get physical chemists to work for free. I should use high school kids to make my medicines."
Well, that's about a $748 difference in the drugs that they made versus what he was selling. What's the public reactions like?
The overriding response was that they enjoy the story of kids' success. But some people pointed out students' alternative option of creating more affordable drugs is not viable due to pharmaceutical regulations. Here's an example. Too bad that issues with the FDA, which stands for Federal Drug Administration here in the States, as well as if it's already patented, will cause it to be almost impossible to sell in the United States.
Okay, let's move on. What else is trending?
A picture of a Texas man holding a "You Belong" sign outside a mosque is making the rounds. Justin Normand of Dallas recently stood near the Islamic Center of Irving with a sign that reads, "You belong, stay strong, be blessed, we are one America." He has been interviewed by multiple media outlets since then and said he wanted to share peace with his neighbors after the election. Social media users mostly welcomed the story, with one user writing, "This is how we change our world for the better. Each of us do our part. This guy can serve as an inspiration for us all." Jim?
Thanks so much, Chi. You can follow our program's account on our Twitter stream at @VOA_IE. You may also follow my account, if you like, at VOA Stevenson. G is at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: Thailand has new king, marking new era. After court battle, Indian women enter landmark mosque with song and tears. Few expect new UN sanctions to deter North Korea. China slaps extra 10% tax on luxury cars. Tokyo organizers promise cost-cutting for the 2020 Olympics. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Reeling from surprising Election Day losses and looking for a way forward, Democrats considered new leadership in the House of Representatives this week. But challenger Tim Ryan ultimately could not unseat longtime Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. VOA's Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill on the next steps for the Democratic Party.
The Election Day message from Rust Belt voters to Capitol Hill Democrats was surprising but clear. It's all about jobs. As Democrats grappled with a new way forward, that message became the rallying cry for Representative Tim Ryan as he challenged longtime House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Ryan failed, but he said his message still holds.
It's jobs, it's wages, it's pensions, it's benefits, and it's not just talking about the minimum wage, it's about talking about middle-class incomes that haven't gone up in 30 years. And we got off that message.
Pelosi emerged from the challenge to her leadership, saying the stakes for the next Congress couldn't be higher.
The fate of our nation, the greatness of America, the character of our country has been under assault, and we have to act to allay the fears that some people have.
Ryan's battle for more diverse voices did result in the election of the first woman of color in Democratic leadership.
As a working mother, I understand how difficult it is to balance family life with work, and we hope to make that a little bit easier for America's working families moving forward.
A rallying cry Democratic voters heard earlier this month on Capitol Hill from Senator Bernie Sanders, who said it was time for a new direction.
The Democratic Party has got to recognize some very important realities that Donald Trump, in fact, did recognize.
One-third of the Democratic caucus split from Pelosi to vote for Ryan. But even as Democrats recovered from those divisions, there were defiant reminders the party won the popular vote.
Millions more people voted for the agenda that this leadership group represents.
And an acknowledgement the incoming Trump administration may make the Democrats' case to voters.
They will see what the Republican Party really stands for. And they will flock to us.
With the battle among Democrats now settled, Pelosi will have a much bigger challenge on her hands, a Trump White House. Catherine Gibson on Capitol Hill, VOA News.
President-elect Donald Trump's future economic team is starting to take shape, but his intention to nominate former Goldman Sachs banker Steven Mnuchin to become the next Treasury Secretary could prove to be a bit controversial given Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail against Wall Street. So who is Steven Mnuchin? Millar Sega explains.
Steven Mnuchin is hardly a household name. He's never held public office, but the 53-year-old Yale graduate has an interesting resume. He was a 17-year partner at Goldman Sachs, a millionaire who started his own hedge fund and later enjoyed a successful stint as a Hollywood producer. But these days, Mnuchin says his focus is on more important matters.
Our number one priority is going to be the economy, get back to 3-4% growth. We believe that's very sustainable, and focus on things for the American worker.
As one of Mr. Trump's earliest supporters and a trusted campaign advisor, market analysts say Mnuchin's appointment was predictable.
You know, the president likes to pick people he's comfortable with, people who got into the bunker with him. And like every president, he's loyal and he wants to reward that loyalty. He's not willing to go outside his inner circle for the moment.
But as the man who would be in charge of overhauling the U.S. tax code, some say the appointment sends the wrong message. On Skype, policy researcher Rick Claypool at the nonpartisan middle-class advocacy group Public Citizen sees a disconnect between campaigner Trump and President-elect Trump.
Mnuchin is exactly the candidate we would expect Trump to appoint if he's embracing Wall Street, not cracking down on it.
Instead, Claypool sees a Mnuchin appointment as a dangerous return to the past.
Policy-wise, I would expect the same kind, a return to some of the riskier activities that led us to the financial crisis and the Great Recession.
But on Wall Street, Mnuchin is seen as an insider and a pretty safe bet.
I think Wall Street's maybe perhaps breathing a little sigh of relief, saying he could have made some more or less conservative choices, so to speak, and picking relatively conservative by Trump standards. I think the market is actually not unhappy with the choices that are made.
The Senate still has to confirm Mnuchin. But given Republican majorities in both houses of Congress, analysts believe Trump is likely to prevail. Millar Sega, VOA News, Washington.
Amnesty International says palm oil producers in Indonesia are committing gross labor abuses, and the human rights group accuses the world's biggest producer, Wilmar, of using child labor and forcing women to work with no pay. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Palm oil is found in a huge range of products, from food to cosmetics. The crop's rapid growth has spawned huge plantations, especially in Southeast Asia. Amnesty International's Meghna Abraham says the burgeoning demand also is driving widespread labour abuses.
We found children as young as 8 working on these plantations helping their parents. We found forced labour where women workers are forced to work for 2 days but only paid for 1 day.
Amnesty interviewed an 8-year-old boy who said he helps his father pick the palm kernels after school. He told the researchers he does not get any money and has to carry very heavy sacks full of palm kernels. Another worker told Amnesty he has no choice but to get his wife and children to help him with the harvest. The plantation is too wide, he says, so it is impossible to do it by himself without help. If I can't meet the target the company sets, he says, then he will get a warning letter from the head of the company. Other workers complain of deteriorating health because of exposure to chemicals, including lung and skin problems. All the plantations were either suppliers to or subsidiaries of the world's biggest palm oil exporter, Singapore-based Wilmar. Again, Amnesty's Meghna Abraham.
Wilmar, as the world's largest trader, is supplying virtually every big company you can think of. So we traced the palm oil from the plantations that we investigated to 9 big household name companies, which include companies like Unilever, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Kellogg's, Colgate-Palmolive.
Those companies all say they take rigorous steps to ensure the sustainability of their palm oil supplies and have pledged to investigate Amnesty's claims.
But there's a big gap between the policies that they have on paper and what's happening on the ground in these plantations.
Wilmar has said it is deeply concerned about Amnesty's allegations and has pledged to take any necessary action to address abuses. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Time now for International Edition's David Byrd and VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee to tell us about Forbes magazine list of highest paid musicians in the world for 2016.
Taylor Swift comes in at number one. She earned $170 million from touring, recording, endorsements, and what's known as other income. She had $200 million on the North American portion of her 1989 tour.
Yeah.
Miss Thang ruled the world.
Well, and it's interesting that she's at the top of this list. She was also at the top of the under 30 list. She was also at the top of the highest paid women in music list. I mean, she's been topping these lists all year long and for many years. She delivers solid music. She's a great live performer, but she's young and relatively non-controversial. So she can rake in the endorsement deals that maybe other artists cannot. And so So there's a lot of money to be made in product and service endorsement. I mean, she was like the New York City representative for a year. I don't think it should be any surprise to anyone that she's at the top of that list, which I think is also awesome considering there weren't very many women on the top half of that list. So for her to actually be at number one says a lot about her star power in general, but specifically as a woman in this industry.
Now let's go to number two, the boy band One Direction. They made scones of money as well, $110 million, grossing $200 million-plus for their On the Road Again tour. Number three was, as far as musicians, was Adele.
Right.
Great concert. Mm-hmm. I saw her in concert here in D.C.
Yeah.
Consummate entertainer.
Because this list was compiled again from June to June, and she just finished her tour
this month.
And well, I guess her Australian dates will be in 2017.
Right.
But it is important to note that probably next year we may see her a bit higher on the list because she will then be able to include the money from June up until November.
All right. Well, let's see. Rounding out the top 10. First of all, we had Madonna at number four as far as the fourth highest ranking musician with $76.5 million. Mm-hmm. Not bad income.
Not
you
bad.
Can get it. Then Rihanna, who had $75 million. Garth Brooks, Entertainer of the Year for the Country Music Association. A couple of geezer bands. AC/DC, who didn't even have their lead singer. Didn't matter. They stuck Axl Rose in there. And like,
yeah, well, he's a big enough name.
Right.
Yeah.
The Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm. No surprise there, I don't think.
No, that's no surprise. Mm-hmm. And then Calvin Harris, Taylor Swift's former boyfriend.
Right.
Before Tom Hiddleston.
Right.
And rounding out the top 10, Diddy.
And Diddy also has the Bad Boy Reunion Tour, so he's probably making some money off of that. But he's got major liquor endorsements and product endorsements, and he's still doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes. So
collectively, the 30 listed musicians, this is according to Forbes now, the 30 listed musicians earned more than $1.8 billion this
year. We're in the wrong business.
I think I need to go home and practice my guitar. Shauna, it is always great to talk with you. If you would like to talk to Shauna, you can hit her up on Twitter. She is at VOA Lady DJ. And you can also find her show, The Soul Lounge, on our website. That's voanews.com.
And that's where you'll find our program, International Edition. Thank you so much for listening and have a wonderful day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In less than 1 year, the global community has made tremendous progress in addressing the numerous issues that negatively affect our climate. Last December, nearly 200 countries concluded negotiations of the Paris Agreement, which aims to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The agreement entered into force in November 2016. Around the same time, the International Civil Aviation Organization adopted an unprecedented global market-based measure that puts the international aviation industry on a path toward sustainable, carbon-neutral growth. And finally, 200 parties of the Montreal Protocol agreed to the Kigali Amendment that will gradually reduce the production and consumption of hydrofluorocarbons, powerful greenhouse gases that are commonly used in refrigeration. And as the world moves towards sustainable energy production, the clean energy market is booming. This trend will only become more pronounced, said Secretary of State John Kerry at the recently held 22nd Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Last year alone, investment in renewable energy was at an all-time high, nearly $350 billion, he said.
That $350 billion is the first time that we've been able to see that money outpacing what is being put into fossil fuels. An average of 500,000 new solar panels were installed every single day last year. And for the first time since the pre-industrial era, despite the fact that you have global prices of oil and gas and coal that are lower than ever, still more of the world's money was invested in renewable energy technologies than in new fossil fuel plants.
Today, our emissions are being driven down because market-based forces are taking hold all over the world, said Secretary of State Kerry. Most business people have come to understand investing in clean energy simply makes good economic sense. You can make money. You can do good and do well at the same time, he said. Ultimately, clean energy is expected to be a multi-trillion dollar market, the largest market the world has ever known. And no nation will do well if it sits on the sidelines, handicapping its new businesses from reaping the benefits of the clean tech explosion.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.